And this week, in the Bible overview series, we're going to cover the law. But before we do that, thought it'd be good to review something of where we've been up to this point. And we started out with creation, Adam and Eve, and we're beginning to see, we've been seeing, been observing the theme of kingdom throughout. And we've seen from the earliest chapters of the Bible the theme of kingdom, where God is king and Adam and Eve are the subjects. Eden is the realm in which God rules, and God gives a kind of delegated dominion and authority over Adam and Eve. And God looks upon all of His creation, and He pronounces it very good. And then from there we move to the fall, which is symbolized with the picture there of the Tower of Babel, a symbol of man and his rebellion against God, where Adam and Eve seek to take the crown off of God's head and to place it on their own head, to make themselves the arbiter of good and evil. I believe that's what it means when it says that they knew good and evil. They had become the arbiter, the determiner of good and evil, because they were seeking to live autonomously from God's word and sought to be a law unto themselves. And after Adam and Eve sinned, the whole human race fell with them. But God did not give up on humanity. We see in Genesis 12, 15, 17, 19, God making a pledge to Abraham. God coming to Abraham and calling him out of Ur, calling him to follow him, and making a promise, promising him a nation, a people, a great name for himself, and through that nation to bless many nations. And then we move from there to the Exodus, which we see a picture of redemption. After Abraham had... after the descendants of Abraham, we see Joseph getting sold into slavery, and then his whole family eventually winds up down in Egypt. And God miraculously and majestically delivers them out of Egypt through the 10 plagues of Egypt. And this gives us a kind of a picture of redemption, a picture in seed form that obviously will be further blown up when in the New Testament, the concept of redemption. But God purchasing His people, buying His people out of slavery from Egypt, and then ultimately bringing them into the promised land. Because of their disobedience for 40 years, they were confined to the desert, not allowed to enter the promised land. But after that generation had died out, God brought them into the promised land under the leadership of Joshua. And the promised land was God fulfilling His, at least in parts, His promise to Abraham that His people would be promised a land, a nation, and that the world would be blessed through them. And then today, we're going to focus upon the law, which is the law in particular that God gave through Moses to the people, which is ultimately was to be a guiding principle for their new life. They were now people that were redeemed. There were people that were now living in the land that God had given them. And now the law was to be their guide and rule of their new life in covenant union with the God of Abraham. And so this is what we're going to focus on today. And we're going to look at four critical truths concerning the law of God that He gave towards Israel. And the first, and now the summary of the law we find most pointedly in Exodus chapter 20, right? With it's sometimes called the Decalogue or the Ten Words, the Ten Commandments. And that is really, in summary form, the law of God. But God's law, it does go broader than those Ten Commandments, but that is the summary form of God's law. But the first critical truth concerning God's law that I think we need to understand is that we must understand God's law in relationship to His grace. Look at Exodus 34, verse 4 to 7. Should have it up there on the slide. I'll read it from the New International Version. It says, so Moses chiseled out, Exodus 34:4, I'll start with that. So Moses chiseled out two stone tablets like the first ones and went up Mount Sinai early in the morning as the Lord had commanded him and carried the two stone tablets in his hands. Then the Lord came down in the cloud and stood there with him and proclaimed his name, the Lord, Yahweh. And he passed in front of Moses proclaiming, the Lord, compassionate and gracious God, slow to anger and abounding in love and faithfulness, maintaining love to thousands and forgiving wickedness, rebellion and sin. Yet he does not leave the guilty unpunished. He punishes the children and their children for the sin of the fathers to the third and fourth generation. So here we see when Moses asks God to show him something of his character, he wants some kind of assurance before he moves on and leads the people of Israel. God will not permit Moses to see his face, but he allows him to see something of his character. And how is his character proclaimed or unfolded? It says in verse 6, the Lord, compassionate and gracious God, slow to anger and abounding in love and faithfulness, maintaining love to thousands, forgiving wickedness and rebellion. But he is still a God of justice. It says, yet he does not leave the guilty unpunished. The guilty unpunished. He punishes the children and their children for the sin of the fathers to the third and to the fourth generation. So the God of the law is a God of compassion, a God of love, a God of grace. And we see this even in the very giving of this covenant law. If you turn back to Exodus chapter 19, let me start with verse 1. It says, in the third month after the sons of Israel had gone out of the land of Egypt, on that very day they came to the wilderness of Sinai. When they set out from Rephidim, they came to the wilderness of Sinai and camped in the wilderness. And there Israel camped in front of the mountain. Moses went up to God, and the Lord called to him from the mountain, saying, thus you shall say to the house of Jacob, and tell the sons of Israel, you yourselves have seen what I did to the Egyptians, and how I bore you on eagle's wings, and brought you to myself. Now then, if indeed you will obey my voice, and keep my covenant, then you shall be my own possession among all the peoples, for all the earth is mine. So notice in Exodus 19:4, before God gives this stipulation for them to obey him, and in obeying him they would be a kingdom of priests, he tells them what he has done for them. What did he do for them in verse 4? He bore them on eagle's wings. He brought them forth from Egypt to himself. They were a redeemed people. So their obedience to God's law and his commands was to be in light of the reality of God redeeming them, of God carrying them on eagle's wings. We see the same thing in chapter 20 with the giving of the summary of the law. In 20 verse 1, it says, then God spoke all these words. This was God speaking. In fact, later on we see that the people were so terrified of God's words that they refused to hear God personally and directly. They would ask Moses to be a mediator for them. But then verse 2, I am Yahweh your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. Before God gives the first commandment, which is the foundation of all the other commandments, that they would have no other gods before him, he first reminds them of what he did for them. This is the God who brought them out of Egypt, out of slavery. This is the God who extended his hand of compassion and grace, and through those 10 plagues, which were all strategically done in such a way as to bring judgment upon the Egyptians, but to show kindness and grace towards the Israelites. God did all this as an act of kindness, grace, fulfilling his covenant promises that he made to Abraham. And it's in light of this reality that God says, you shall have no other gods before me. You shall make no graven images. You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain. You shall keep the Sabbath. You shall not lie. You shall not bear false. Go on and on. All these commandments were to be in light of his grace. Now, when we're speaking to an unbeliever, we speak law first, and then we point them to grace. But when we're talking to a believer, it's grace first and then law. Because grace becomes the very motivation for us to obey the law. But an unbeliever doesn't properly understand God's grace, and that's why you have to do law first to point him to understand God's grace. And this is a truth that is really... We see it foundationally in the Old Testament, but then we see it even more explicitly in the New Testament. Turn to Titus chapter 2, verse 11 and 12. Titus chapter 2, it says, for the grace of God has appeared, bringing salvation to all men. Now, sometimes it's asked, who is the all men? Is this speaking that God's grace goes to every single person without exception? Well, it's qualified by verse 12. Who is it that the grace, who is this all men that the grace of God appears to? Instructing us to deny ungodliness and worldly desires and to live sensibly, righteously, and godly in the present age. So when the grace of God comes home to a person, this grace is the actor. It's the actor in verse 12 that instructs. It teaches. Paideia, it's the teacher. What does it teach? It teaches us negatively to deny ungodliness and worldly desires. So negatively, God's grace teaches us to abstain from ungodliness, disobedience, and to abstain from worldly desires, the desires that motivate the people of this world. But then positively, the very opposite, to live sensibly, that is self-controlled. Rather than giving yourself to worldly desires, you give yourself to controlled desires, righteously and godly in the present age. So the grace of God becomes critical in understanding the law of God, because ultimately it becomes the motivation for our obedience to God. It's the primary motivation, not the only motivation for us to obey God. God gives a multitude of motivations. Sometimes he just says, I'll lay the smack down on you if you disobey. I will make life very painful for you if you disobey. It's a legitimate motivation to wake us up, but ultimately the main artery that we get the nutrients to give us the energy for which we are to obey God is the grace of God. For the Israelites, foundationally in the Old Testament, this was realizing, wow, God has been so gracious. He came to our forefather Abraham. He called him out of Ur. He then mightily and powerfully delivered us from the hands of the Egyptians and brought us into a land that we had not built these buildings. We had not cultivated this land. This was his promised land. And so in light of that, God tells the Israelites to obey him. To obey him. And it's the same thing for us. If you find yourself weak in the area of obedience, perhaps you need a healthy dose of the reminder of God's grace towards you. His justifying grace, that he would pardon you, that you would be not guilty before him, that he would impute the very righteousness of Christ to you, that he would have came to you in your life of wickedness and drew you out, maybe not with the 10 plagues of Egypt, but perhaps with your own experiences. He made himself known to you and brought you into covenant relationship with you. And now he says, make no other gods before me. Do not make graven images. Do not take my name in vain. So God's grace, God's law must be understood in relationship to his grace. But then, secondly, God's law must be understood as separating Israel and ultimately us from the world. This is the next slide that we should have up there, but if you have nimble fingers, you can turn to Deuteronomy chapter 6. Deuteronomy chapter 6 and verse 20. It says, in the future, when your son asks you, what is the meaning of the stipulations, decrees, and laws the Lord our God has commanded you? Tell him, we were slaves of Pharaoh in Egypt, but the Lord brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand. Before our eyes, the Lord sent miraculous signs and wonders, great and terrible, upon Egypt and Pharaoh and his whole household. But he brought us out from there to bring us into, to bring us in and give us the land that he promised on oath to our forefathers. The Lord commanded us to obey all these decrees and to fear the Lord our God, so that we might always prosper and be kept alive, as is the case today. And if we are careful to obey all of his all this law before the Lord our God, as he has commanded, that he will be our righteousness. So Moses tells the Israelites in the coming generations, when the people ask you, what's with all these laws? They're to remind their children that these laws and commandments are rooted in what God has done for us. And now God is calling us to be now a separate, distinct people. And that's what much of the laws that we see laid out in Exodus, in Leviticus, in Numbers, in Deuteronomy, that's what they're for. To make the people of Israel a holy people. Now that word holy, in and of itself, does not necessarily connotate moral purity. But because it is the kind of holiness that is God's holiness, and God's separateness consists of righteousness, so the people of Israel, their kind of holiness was to be a righteous holiness. The reason why I say that, because the very word for holy, kadosh, in some translations speaks of male cult temple prostitutes who are set apart for their work. Obviously, that's not inherently a moral kind of purity. But it's just saying they were set apart for this work. Well, God's kind of holiness does consist of a kind of moral purity, but it also consists of a kind of uniqueness. God giving some of these commands just to make them distinct from the rest of the world, to make them a different kind of people. And God's commandments, God's laws, really ultimately reflect His character. We see that in the Ten Commandments most explicitly. You can tell the character of somebody, who they are, by the commands that they give. If you go into somebody's house and you're immediately told to take your shoes off, they're probably Asian. That's their character. If you're on the road and somebody has certain unspoken laws that there should not be any vehicle in front of them at any time, it's probably because they're impatient. Well, in the same way, God, His commands, His laws are rooted and anchored in His very character. So when He gives the command not to have any other gods before Him, it tells us something about God's jealousy for His own glory, His own worship. When we see Him giving a command for no graven images, it tells us something that God does not want to be represented by anything in creation, because nothing in creation could fully explain who He is. When He gives a command not to lie, it tells us something of His character as a God of truth. When He gives commands not to commit adultery, it tells us something of His character as a faithful God. We see His character put on display most explicitly with what we might call the moral aspect of the law. But there's other aspects of the law, and although the Bible doesn't necessarily make this distinction, I think it's a helpful distinction as you work your way through the Pentateuch and you see all these different laws and commands. Some of them are moral laws, where you see commands not to lie, and this moral law usually transcends all different periods of God's dealing with humanity. We see these commands in the New Testament as well as before the law was ever given. But then there's also civil law. This would be different commands to govern the people, much like we have civil laws today, certain laws concerning traffic violations, speed limits, things like that, and certain punishments that go along with those civil laws. Turn to Exodus 21 for an example of civil law. Exodus 21:22. It says, if men struggle with each other and strike a woman with child so that she gives birth, yet there is no injury, he shall surely be fined as the woman's husband may demand of him, and he shall pay as the judges decide. So, situation, two guys get in a fight, and the one evidently hits a woman who's pregnant, and there's no permanent damages. There's a fine that's to be rendered that somehow has the input of the husband as well as the judge who's ruling over the case. Verse 23. But if there's any further injury, then you shall appoint as penalty as a penalty, life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, bruise for bruise. Now, sometimes people take a verse like this and say, use it as an argument for personal revenge. See, you hit my car, now I'm going to key your car. That's not what this verse is talking about. This verse was to be a guiding principle for judges who ruled in certain cases. A guiding principle that if X damage was done here, then the person has to pay X damage. And it was a guiding principle so as that punishment would not be exorbitant concerning the crime, and also that the punishment would be fitting. It would mete out the requirements of the crime. And in this case, the situation is still the same case with two men who are fighting and the woman gets hurt. And now he says, if there's any further damage, let there be life for life. And it seems to me the implication is that if the woman gives birth and the baby dies or the woman herself dies, then that person actually, whoever killed her, is to pay with their own life. Eye for eye, tooth for tooth, etc. But then verse 26, and if a man strikes the eye of his male or female slave and destroys it, let him go free on the account of his eye. If he knocks out a tooth of his male or female slave, so he shall let him go free on the account of his tooth. If an ox gores a man or a woman to death, the ox shall surely be stoned, and its flesh shall not be eaten, but the owner of the ox shall go unpunished. If, however, an ox was previously in the habit of goring, and its owner has been warned, yet he does not confine it and it kills a man or a woman, the ox shall be stoned, and the owner shall be put to death. That's, you know, we have similar laws, right? We have laws against the, you know, pit bulls and dogs. You know, if the dog gets loose and does something, you know, there's some kind of retribution that is paid, but, you know, it's not necessarily a severe penalty. But if this dog is known to be a vicious dog that attacks other people, and the owner has been warned time and time again, that owner can pay severe punishment for failing to keep his dog under control or to put that dog down. And these are some of the civil laws of the land, and we can go on and on with all these different civil laws. And so, obviously, when we come into the time of the New Testament, where God isn't ruling Israel in the same way that He rules the church with these different case laws and civil laws, many of these laws don't explicitly apply, although there's still principles that are behind these laws. In other words, not letting your ox gore your neighbor to death. That's basically loving your neighbor. Being concerned about human dignity and human life. So there's principles that lie behind these civil laws, but the civil laws don't explicitly apply today. Although it is interesting that many of the laws in Western culture are rooted and anchored in much of the case law and civil law of the Old Testament. So, moral law, civil law, but also we have ceremonial law. Turn to Leviticus 11. Leviticus 11, we'll start with verse 1. Leviticus 11:1 says, "The Lord spoke again to Moses and Aaron, saying to them, Speak to the sons of Israel, saying, These are the creatures which you may eat from all the animals that are on the earth. Whatever divides a hoof, thus making split hoofs, and chews the cud among the animals, you may eat. Nevertheless, you are not to eat of these among those which chew the cud, or among those which divide the hoof, the camel, for it chews cud and does not divide the hoof. It is unclean to you. Likewise, the chiffon, for though it chews the cud, it does not divide the hoof. It is unclean to you. The rabbit, no rabbit stew. The rabbit also, for though it chews the cud, it does not divide the hoof. It is unclean to you. No ham, no bacon, no pork chops. And the pig, for though it divides the hoof, thus making a split hoof, it does not chew the cud. It is unclean to you. You shall not eat of their flesh, nor touch their carcasses. They are unclean to you. Some of these ceremonial laws, these were consisted of the dietary laws that were commands that were given to Israel to keep them a separate and distinct people, to keep them distinct from the rest of the nations. God was calling them to be a holy people. We see this also with some of these other laws. Leviticus chapter 19. By the way, sometimes people go through some of these ceremonial laws of concerning cleanliness and concerning the dietary restrictions, and kind of argue for the health reasons concerning that. There may be some validity to that, but I don't think that was God's intention in giving them. It was more so, like he says over and over throughout Leviticus, what? Be holy. Why? For I am holy. Be separate, for I am separate. These commands were given to keep Israel separate. Leviticus chapter 19, verse 26. This is I specifically picked this for those who want to get tattoos or have tattoos, so you don't have an overly burdened conscience. Verse 26, you shall not eat anything with blood, nor practice divination or soothsaying. Sideburns are out. Verse 27, you shall not round off the side growth of your heads, nor harm the edges of your beard. You shall not make any cuts in your body for the dead, or make tattoo marks on yourselves. I